If you're staring at a screen right now, and we have the stats of our listeners, most of you listen online, then it probably makes sense that the average American spends more than 10 hours a day in front of a screen. But does that mean you're hooked? Jason Middleton chats with Adam Alter about what he discovered when looking into addictive behavior and technology on this week's Techonomics.
Hello and welcome back, as always. Recently, we hosted a marketing expert. His name is Nir Eyal, and his program helps makers create products that are basically irresistible to consumers. This week, we're taking the opposite tack. An author and sociologist who examines the rise of behavioral addiction and offers some suggestions for alleviating our own addictive behavior. If you can stop checking, clicking, surfing, and liking for just a little bit, put your device down and read Adam Alter's Irresistible. That's a quote from Arianna Huffington, who has her own recent book about the importance of sleep. Here's part one of two of my chat with the author of Irresistible.
Adam Alter, I'm an associate professor of marketing and psychology at New York University, and I'm an author.
Yes, you are. And your book is Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. And I definitely want to get into the meat of that book. But I have to say, we are glad to have you because recently we had Nir Eyal on. And his new book, of course, is called Hooked. And during that conversation, he offered that maybe you two could get in a studio at some point and have a little bit of a, not a debate, but a conversation. So I'm hoping that that sounds of interest to you, too.
It sounds very interesting to me. Yeah, I've talked to Nir about that, actually. And what's interesting to me is that his book obviously comes at the issue from the other side. He's very interested in showing businesses how to hook. I think he's softened in his stance a little bit since then. He's not just interested in how businesses can hook consumers, but I certainly come squarely from the other perspective. I'm more interested in consumer protection.
Absolutely. And you come at it from an addiction angle, obviously, as well. So let's go ahead and let's ask you for your working definition of addiction, and maybe we can unravel from there.
I focus really on behavioral addiction. So these are addictions that don't involve substances, but the definition is very similar. Behavioral addiction is any behavior that you return to over and over again, and you do that because in the short term it feels good to you, but in the long term it turns out to undermine your well-being in at least one respect.
I see. And then it can leach into other areas of your life as well. That seems to be a creeping thing that happens with addiction, whether it's behavioral or chemical. Is that right, too?
Exactly, yeah. So one of the ways it can diminish your well-being is by, say, eating into your social life, by eating into your finances, making you less healthy. It can do lots of different things, and it often does more than one thing. But what's critical to the definition is that in the long run, it's bad for you.
Well, let's use the ubiquity of your cover image, this smartphone that's on the cover of your book, Irresistible. Was that a trigger for you, or what was the impetus behind the book? Were you staring at your smartphone one day, maybe, or maybe chunking out a whole bunch of emails and was just like, wait a second, what am I doing here?
Well, I'm a psychologist, and one of the things I do as an academic psychologist is I try to work out what ideas are interesting to pursue. And often what I'll do is I'll notice that I'm doing something strange and then ask whether I'm the only one in that position. I noticed that a lot of my time was being sucked up by screen experiences. I was playing games that would eat into work time, eat into time that I thought I should be spending with family and friends. The same was happening with email. I find that I'd stay up an hour or two past when I wanted to go to bed because I felt I had to answer all my emails. Enough of these things were happening at around the same time in my life that I started to wonder whether we were giving up too much of our time and too much of our well-being to screens. And that's why the cover image ended up being a screen, because I think a lot of these experiences happen on screens.
You mentioned, Dr. Alter, that you're an email completionist. Is that more of a sign of just being an efficient and hardworking person with momentum and drive, or did you really tip into the addiction period of it, or the what felt like an addiction?
I think it feels to me like it goes well beyond just being productive, because it eats into my sleep, as I said, and I wish I didn't feel such a hold, that I didn't feel like I had to go every night and make sure that my inbox had got down to zero, which is the way I work. And it does feel like I'm beholden to email in some respect. So it's not just that I'm efficient. I think it's also something that I feel I can't do without. And so that, to me, suggests that it's into a slightly less healthy territory.
Right. Okay. Thank you for clarifying. And I think that there might be a demographic thing here when it comes to email as well. But I believe that the younger generation are kind of more addicted to social networking for maybe a similar reason, maybe not. What's your explanation for that?
Yeah, I think social networking is slightly different. The thing with email is that there is this goal, this inbox zero goal that a lot of people pursue, where they want to get their inboxes down to zero emails at all time. That's my problem. With social networking, I think there are other factors that drive, especially teens and adolescents, to stay on for hours at a time. One of the big things is that it's sort of the bedrock of their social lives, and most of what goes on for them socially happens on social media, so much so that I've got friends who are psychologists, and they'll tell me that they'll have a client who will be sitting and telling them a story, and the client will say something like, and then I said this to my friend, and my friend said this to me, and they'll retell an entire story, and eventually the psychologist will say, hang on, how did this happen? What was the medium? And they'll learn that this all happened through a series of texts. But the way teens and adolescents think of these experiences is that they're real. These are not very different for them from face-to-face communication.
Have we allowed children or younger adults, younger people, let's say, too much access too quickly to things we may not understand?
I think possibly, yeah. I think it's very easy to give them that kind of access, partly because once they get a taste of it, it's very hard to wean them off or to get them to use those devices and those platforms less. And so it's not that I blame parents. It's not that I'm puritanical. But I do think that it's important that we try at least to limit how much time, not just teens, but all of us spend on these devices.
You know, you mentioned very prominently in your book a use case of a school here in Silicon Valley. Can you talk to us a little bit about that story and how it helped you kind of drive the book forward?
Yeah, it was one of the first things I investigated. I was very curious about how the experts thought about these screens. You know, it's always a good place to begin is to ask, who knows the most about these things, and then what are they doing? And one thing I found that was pretty strange was that a lot of the people who produce screen technology, a lot of the tech titans who work at these large corporations like the Apples and Googles and Facebooks, they are very cautious about exposing their kids and even themselves to screens. So there's a school called the Waldorf School of the Peninsula, which is not too far from Silicon Valley. The school doesn't introduce screens at all until the eighth grade, and then they do it in a what's known as a slow tech way, which means that they introduce them to teach kids how to program and learn how to make the content rather than just to consume on the screen.
I see.
And what's really interesting about this school is that 75% of the kids have parents who are high-level execs in Silicon Valley, particularly in tech and screen-based industries. So these are parents who are saying publicly, here are my products, they're wonderful, and privately they're preventing their kids from using these screens during the day.
Right. That is a dichotomy for certain. Here in Silicon Valley, a common thread that happens is innovation, right? Envelope pushing, new technologies, new platforms. Then inevitably the conversation has to turn towards legislation / regulation. Have you taken your argument or your concern to the level where you've given consideration to whether regulatory steps would be necessary?
Yeah, I've thought about it. It's a tricky issue. You know, I think especially in the United States, there's a strong cultural imperative that suggests that we have liberty. And I think suggesting to people that they aren't allowed to use technology is fraught. It's difficult to do that and to have people support any government that tries to impose those kind of limitations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an area that I think is worth considering and pursuing. But at this stage, I don't think it's the natural next step. I think what needs to happen before that is that to some extent the companies that produce these forms of technology should do a sort of internal audit. So I've spoken to a lot of them and they've become pretty cautious about these issues. Some of them say we didn't really know this was an issue until you explained it to us, and others obviously do understand that it is, and they use it in a sort of hooked sense where they're trying to ensnare consumers. But I think if they at least sort of incorporate some of these ideas into the products they're designing, I think that would be a better first step than going straight to legislation.
That's fair enough. And you also mentioned in that answer, we're back to the addiction thing. And the video gaming example, one of the examples you used in there was obviously an extreme, but it obviously was very true as well. And is video gaming something you'd also like to portion off? As you said, that social networking is a little bit different than email because of the completionist aspect to it. Is gaming something completely different too?
Gaming incorporates a lot of these elements that hook people, I think. So there is the goal aspect that you want to complete goals. There's often a very social element. So a lot of the big games that have a lot of people hooked are games where you play with other people. And so you feel that you need to be online all the time, especially if you're playing with people who are around the world in different time zones. So I think there are a lot of elements that make games very difficult to resist once you start playing them. Certainly, it's worth considering. I'm not sure about legislation, but it's to me, gaming is just one small step removed from gambling because they use so many of the same cues, the same hooks, the same approaches. And so to the extent that we legislate gambling behavior, I think it's worth considering something similar for gaming.
That was Adam Alter. He's the author of Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. We have another segment with Adam as well, so please go to KGORadio.com/Techonomics if you'd like more about our irresistible attraction to our devices. You can also find us at Facebook.com/Techonomics Radio. We have links there. We have stories that catch our eye. And the music we choose for each week's show is also there. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.